ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The Breakfast Wrap is your chance to find out just what's happening here and around the world. From the ABC's National Breakfast Radio program, we take the very best interviews with the people that matter.
John Howard, welcome back.
Former FBI analyst is the assistant minister, but Entercop turned chairmaker Glenn Rundle.
And all of those guys were from just one show. The Breakfast Wrap, 25 minutes at 11:30 every morning on Radio National, or stream it whenever you like on ABC Listen.
As the media landscape continues to shift, the Prime Minister has committed to fixing the news bargaining code to ensure platforms contribute their fair share. Anthony Albanese has announced the news media bargaining incentive has progressed to the next stage, unveiling an exposure draft of the legislation. Meanwhile, the opposition has unveiled a plan to double Australia's fuel reserves from 30 days to 60 days, as energy security remains a key focus, of course, for everyone. And the first ever woman has been appointed as Secretary for the Department of Defence, while the Trump administration has nominated a candidate for US Ambassador to Australia. Do you have whiplash yet? We will help you. Welcome to Politics Now. Hi, I'm Patricia Carvelis.
And I'm Mel Clark, host of AM. And PK,
there's so much going on.
I almost don't know where we're going to start. Yeah. There's so much to get into.
There's a lot, but we'll start here. So we're going to come to the coalition's fuel reserve policy because it is really interesting. They're obviously trying to up the ante on all of this and, you know, be the ones that go first. They were the first to go on the fuel excise cut. And now, no doubt the government has been looking at ideas like this, perhaps in a little thing called the budget coming out soon. Anyway, all of this news comes as the US President Donald Trump has revealed his nomination for the US ambassador to Australia. We've been waiting for this announcement. Now we have it. The PM had a big press conference where he did two very significant things, I think. One is finally unveiling the new defence secretary. Her name is Megan Quinn. She's currently the person in charge of the industry department. So she's a very, very respected public servant that they think has the economic nous and brain to run a big department like defence when its budget's been expanded. And then the other announcement, which we will get to now, is the news media bargaining incentive. What's that all about? Well, you're going to help me explain it, but the big idea is think about Facebook, think about Meta, generally all the things they make and how they take all of our stuff that we make, and I say we, journalists, media organisations, the original journalism, and don't pay for it. And, of course, there was a deal and there wasn't a deal, and Mel, now we have a deal and it's legislation. What does the deal look like?
Look, you'd be forgiven for barely keeping up with this. This is the policy that has proved to be nearly impossible to get the settings right. From the very beginning of this conception of how to deal with social media companies and search engines really getting the benefit of journalism without having to pay for it, the government's really struggled to get the policy settings right that actually work. Even this idea of, well, we want you to strike a deal to pay for it, and if you don't, we'll put a tax on you. We've had some, over the years, pretty hefty bargaining negotiation techniques, threats to walk away, temporary bans on content as part of that. We thought there had been a settled policy. We did have deals struck between the big tech platforms and media companies that seemed to be working to some extent until Meta, so you know, the owner of Facebook, walked away from it. And that's where the government has really had to reconsider this. So what the government's announced today with the announcement of this exposure draft of legislation is a new system that effectively nominates three platforms, Meta, Google and TikTok, and they will have to pay effectively a tax of between 1.5% and 2.25%, 2.5%. So in that sort of order, there's clearly parameters there. We haven't seen all the detail yet.
Although, if you call it a tax to the government, they'll slap you.
Oh, it's not a tax. It's an incentive charge.
Yeah. Anyway, but I get what you mean.
What do you want to call it?
It's effectively
a tax. It is a payment. It is a payment that they would be.
I'm on Team Mel on tax, but I'm just saying tax, such a vexed word. Please continue, my friend.
Look, we have had high court cases over the definition of a tax. So it's very reasonable to point out what is or isn't a tax, but effectively they would have to pay a proportion of their revenue, and they can lower that liability by striking deals with large and small media companies. And there's various financial incentives to make it effectively cheaper for them to strike a deal than to have to pay the charge in full and not strike a deal. So we'll have to wait and see how the big tech companies respond to this. But the question is, what is in this that stops the tech companies from just walking away altogether and saying, this is all too hard, we just won't operate our platform in your jurisdiction? Because it's something they've threatened to do in past negotiations, and had this having just been announced, I haven't been able to go through every section of the exposure draft of the legislation, but I think that's a real question here, because the tech companies have shown in the past that they are very willing to play hardball, and Australia not being a particularly large jurisdiction for these tech companies, they have in the past been willing to throw their weight around. Are they going to try and push back again? Or do you think all of the negotiations that have taken place and to this point, PK, will be enough that the government's got enough of a nod from the companies that this would be an acceptable arrangement? What do you think?
They are suggesting, we're recording this before we check with all of them, and by the way, they're hard to check with. Government. I've been whinging for my whole career about governments and their lack of transparency, all colours of government. But you try and ask questions of a tech company, and honestly, You need a therapy team after the process. They are so bad at answering questions. So I don't know when we'll know exactly, but you would think from the way the government's gone in and the careful way that, for instance, the Assistant Treasurer, Daniel Molino, who has really been spearheading a lot of this with Annika Wells, the Communications Minister, I think they have really heavily, heavily negotiated with them. But I don't know. These guys, as you say, are not easy to negotiate with. These multinational companies have more power than any governments. That is clear. And that's a whole other podcast about how to moderate and deal with them and how anti-competitive it all is. The Prime Minister says they will be subject to these higher payments if they do walk away. That is the consequence that they'll slap on them. That's obviously very real. They want to operate here in Australia. So you would think this would be a possible, you know, way of doing it, but there's a lot of question marks, I have, I've got to say.
There's a lot of question marks and a lot of detail that's still not figured out. No. I mean, it's pretty clear from this exposure draft, they're still consulting on what they call the distribution model. But this is basically, if the deals aren't struck with individual media companies and they have to pay this charge that's not a tax, that's a charge to the government, and then the government gives it to media organisations, well, which media organisations do they give it to? Who gets how much? How do you make sure it's got the right balance between the big media companies, but also the smaller ones that would be having their work published and distributed on these social media sites? That in itself is going to be a very difficult negotiation, and that's just one tiny part of this legislation. So look, this is a certainly a big milestone in trying to progress a better version of this bargaining incentive, but we still have a long way to go before we have a final policy parameter that is actually going to be functional and delivering revenue to media organisations for the journalism they do.
Yeah, and just think about how much, just this is a broader comment, how much now of the federal government's time is spent talking, managing these big multinational tech companies, you know, seriously, like from the under 16s ban to how to tax them to, the whole digital literacy piece.
It's how the brave to
ensure
new world,
that groom children.
It's the brave new world. We don't even know how to operate in this environment of new tech that's developing faster than I think most of us can keep up with. Then trying to legislate and figure out how to regulate that.
And by the time you legislate, it's already outdated. And then obviously you try and make the rules not too punitive so that there can be, you know, a fair kind of process for them to exist and for people to be able to use different technology. Anyway, radical pivot. But the biggest story we've been talking about for months and months and months, which is a couple of months anyway, which is, of course, the fuel crisis. And now the coalitions try to get out in front of this. They've unveiled a new energy security proposal to boost our onshore fuel reserves. As I said before, this is about getting it to 60 days worth rather than the current 30 days worth. So it sounds to me, Mel, as I heard it argued, like a good proposal. Obviously, we want, you know, it's a longer term proposal. It doesn't deal with the immediate crisis, but for an opposition to say, hey, we have a plan here. And interestingly, and I thought in your interview on AM with Matt Canavan, the Nationals leader, he was really clear. He kept saying, I'm being upfront here. It will be pushed on to consumers a little bit. It's not all going to be funded by the taxpayer. I thought they were pretty upfront about that.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think you were absolutely correct earlier on when you were saying, look, they might just be trying to get ahead of where the government is going here, because clearly this experience has showed that the question of how much fuel reserves we have in the country or on the way to the country is of critical importance. The government has been very much focused on, well, what are our immediate needs, and obviously building more storage or for refining or for already refined fuels in the country is a more longer term proposition, something you'd do over the next 4 years or so. But there's no doubt that they would be considering what options and incentives there are for more storage capacity here. We've even seen the states do that. So what we have now is the coalition entering the fray with a more clearer policy. So they're suggesting that they would try and, as you say, double the amount we can host onshore, so get to 60 days worth of fuels. They suggest that they could do that by giving concessional loans to either refiners or fuel suppliers so that they would have financial support in undertaking more storage capacity on a commercial basis. So the figure they're putting forward is it would cost $800 million in concessional loans, and that would be a government contribution towards a project that would otherwise cost around $6 billion. And Matt Canavan is saying, look, yes, to some extent, fuel suppliers would pass on the cost of having to do that, but we think it's only going to be about 1 cent a litre at the Bowser, and that's worth it when you consider the risks that come with being stuck without fuel, which are obviously quite significant. I think it's really interesting that the opposition is going down this line. It certainly fits in the broader ethos that we are seeing the coalition move towards, particularly pushed by the Nationals and some of those further on the right in the Liberal Party, which is very focused on sovereign capacity, self-sufficiency. Having more capacity to store fuel here in Australia certainly fits in with that category. But it's at odds with their other policies of, well, we don't want higher debt, we don't want more taxes, but we're going to offer up government taxpayer money to try and support a commercial enterprise. And that's where you're getting this concession from Matt Canavan. I think he does deserve a bit of credit for being upfront of saying, well, we will have to borrow a bit of money, but we think it's worthwhile. It will cost you a bit more at the Bowser, but we think that's the right risk calculation. So I give them a bit of credit for being upfront about the give and take and not trying to promise everything to everyone, which I think sometimes does happen when you're trying to develop policy in opposition.
Matt Canavan, remember, is of the, I mean, he came on Four Corners and said basically, no to the free market. No, you know, like this is a guy who his political ideology is already very interventionist, and already he believes very much in you do subsidise when you need to. That's kind of the school of politics economics he comes from. So I don't think this is much of a stretch for him. For the Liberals, though, I mean, they've been on this in the departure lounge from the free market for a while, haven't they? This isn't the first dabbling in propping up industries they've done. And there's been a right-wing push to this direction from people like Andrew Hastie and others who are saying, you know, we used to make cars. This is obviously not cars, but making refineries. I mean, they are not economic.
Well, even around oil exploration is exactly an example of what you're talking about, PK. You've got a Matt Canavan who's like, yeah, let's drill. And if we need to have government support to make it economic, let's do it. If you hear Angus Taylor as the leader of the Liberals and perhaps a more traditional conservative Liberal, he's much more reluctant to make comments that suggest they're signing up to government-funded enterprises or direct industry intervention in that kind kind of mean. So there's definitely a tension there. But nonetheless, you've got Matt Canavan and others continuing to talk about the need to have greater government involvement in getting oil here, in processing oil here, in refining oil here. And at some point, I mean, they're lucky they're in opposition. There's only an extent to which they have to put forward ideas. But there is still tension there behind the scenes.
Now, changing the topic again, we did say you might get whiplash, so get your neck ready. We have coming to our shores a new ambassador. So the position
has been
vacant.
waiting for this.
We have been waiting for this.
We have been waiting for this for a long, long time.
So the position's been vacant since Ambassador Caroline Kennedy, yes, of the Kennedy family fame, ended her posting in 2024. Trump administration today confirmed David Brash was their pick for the posting. His history is very Tea Party movement. Sometimes a fill-in host for Steve Bannon's War Room podcast. We are talking super right-wing, right? I mean, there's a lot of super right-wing, but super, super, super. He's definitely part of the MAGA crowd, but he's, you know, even predates this version of the MAGA crowd, really. Like, he's long viewed himself on the ultra-right of things. If you do a quick little search, as I did when he got announced, you'll see he has dabbled in conspiracy theories and, for instance, not a conspiracy theory, this one more just his view that is contentious. He believes, you know, let Russia do what they want with Ukraine. That's a very contentious view, of course. But he's coming here.
It's going to be very interesting. I mean, I'm personally disappointed it wasn't Sylvester Stallone or Mel Gibson or John Voight, which were names that had been thrown around. And we know that there
John
had been discussions about it.
Oh, come on. I've seen reporting. No offence to you and your people. I lived in Canberra for, you know, a lot of years and I spent a lot of time there, of course, Mel. Love Canberra. But a lot of reporting that there's a lot of bit of a lack of interest about living in our nation's capital.
I'm afraid that was also what I was told, that there was a desire for them to come, but not from themselves to have to live in the other side of the world.
I love Canberra. As I say, if you're listening in Canberra, you live in God's country, beautiful mountains, best, most crisp mornings. I mean, I love the place.
It's peak autumn weather in Canberra now. I can tell you it's beautiful.
Beautiful seasons. All of that's true. But it's a small place. And if you like the big lights, you might think maybe, I can see the Opera House and the Sydney Harbour Bridge. I reckon that would incentivise more, wouldn't you say? Anyway, that's not where you get to go. You have to go to Canberra. And so now we get a man called David Brash, and good luck, Albanese.
I think it's going to be really interesting because his views on foreign policy are probably what are of most interest to Australia. And his views are certainly radically different from what we've seen with predecessors, right? So as you mentioned, when it comes to things like Russia's invasion of Ukraine, he's expressed views to the effect that Ukraine needs to understand that Russia's a big power and it's not going to want someone with different views right on its doorstep. And what it really needs to do is accept the might that Russia has, but also suggests that Russia's power is on the wane and Ukraine sort of just needs to vacate the space and wait for Russia's power to decline. And he kind of makes the same kind of remarks around China as well. He is not a China hawk, as there are many in senior levels of US government. He is someone that thinks China's power is overstated and therefore less of a concern. I think that would be of a great deal of interest and possibly alarm among some of the Australian defence community, who would be worried if there was going to be more influence going to the top levels of US government suggesting that China is something you don't need to worry about, given we've built a military strategy with the US based around a threat from China. So I think the injection of his foreign policy ideas is where there is a really potential for this to be very, very different from anything we've experienced before.
Yeah, hold on to your hats.
Oh,
yes. Just finally, we mentioned that there is a new defence secretary. That's a big deal for lots of reasons. But one of the reasons is, you may have noticed through some of the announcements, one of the only places where the budget will be growing when in a period of sort of minor austerity, I won't go too hard with the word austerity, but a bit of, you know, belt tightening, is actually defence.
I was just going to say, if we were talking about definitions of tax and when to use it or not, the word austerity and when to use it or not will get you just as much feedback, PK.
Yeah, I love feedback. Not. Well, look, you know, the Treasurer has told me numerous times that, you know, this is a this is all about the sort of pulling back a bit. Obviously, inflation is a central issue for the government. That's all happening. That's a vibe. In defence, not happening so much. Of course, they are. I just want to be clear. They are sort of cutting back some areas of defence and then redirecting it to the areas they want to put priority in. So there's a bit of sort of creative spending options also. Back to this appointment. What are the credentials of this woman? Well, she's got heaps of credentials. Megan Quinn has worked not just in the Department of Treasury, where she was Deputy Secretary. She was head of the Secretariat for the Australia and the Asia Century White Paper at the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. There's lots of other jobs too. She's worked for BHP and the Bank of England. She's the first woman to do the job. In fact, the Prime Minister was asked about gender equity. He says the reason she was appointed is she's the standout candidate, and I think that's right.
She does have a very impressive public service CV.
Hugely impressive. She's clearly a really, really, really sharp person. Also, she's got a big sort of economics background. Now, you'd think, why aren't we going military fatigues? Why are we going economic background? Well, because defence has been the problem child. They are very bad at spending money and very wasteful. So I believe that's part of the vibe here. Am I right?
Yeah, I think there's something in that for sure. I mean, she's previously been a Deputy Secretary of Treasury. She's worked in the private sector with the Bank of England. She's worked with Prime Minister and Cabinet. She absolutely has a strong economic background to bring to a high spending area of the public service. But I looked at her CV and thought, the reason they've brought her in is because she does have clearly excellent understanding of how the public service operates. And the Defence Department is about to go through a very significant structural change. You'll remember that the Defence Minister, Richard Marles, announced that they're going to carve out of the Defence Department all of the procurement-related aspects of the work and have that in a separate, independent, standalone agency. And that's where all the spending is. But going through this transition of hiving off a huge part of what the Department of Defence does into a separate agency is really a position of change. And I think they've brought in someone with a lot of public service experience because they need to shepherd that change through, and that will be a difficult process. So I think that broader change to how the government is trying to manage the costs of procurement that you rightly point out are very much the problem child of the government is a key reason why they've decided that Megan Quinn is the right person for this job at this time.
Mm. Just before we wrap today, I just want to acknowledge that it has been 30 years since the Port Arthur massacre. That's the worst mass shooting, of course, in Australia's history. It was a huge turning point in Australia's history, a defining moment, I think, in political history. A moment most of us, if we're alive, and some of you would not even have been here yet, but for those of you who were, is seared in our memory of the country, either as reporters, but I wasn't quite a reporter, I was too young, but I remember it well.
I think you make a really good point there, and it's something that struck me in more recent times, is that it obviously, when it happened, became such a moment of shared understanding of the destructive power of gun violence for the country. And I think that is seared in the minds of everyone who was alive and aware of news at the time, even if they didn't have a direct connection. But with the passage of time, there is less connection to it. There are so many people who weren't alive at the time, or they've migrated to Australia since then, and they're just not familiar with the circumstances and the collective feeling it brought at the time of the need to deal with gun crimes. And so I think being able to reflect on it 30 years on is a really good way of passing on that sense and the lessons that have been learnt of the time to a new generation as well. That's been what I've been thinking about today.
Well, that's it for Politics Now for today. Tomorrow, David Spears will join me for the latest, including new inflation figures. Oh, that's always, yeah.
There's a lot of other reports coming out this week as well. It's that funny pre-budget period, PK, where we're getting little bits of information the government wants to roll out before the budget comes. Mm. We've got some other work being done independently that's rolling out. I think you're going to have a few more Politics Now episodes with some crowded agendas.
Crowded agendas. I like how you said that. It's kind of, I just watched the episode of The West Wing. Everyone knows I'm rewatching that with my daughter because I've told them before because I overshare. Some of you hate it. Some of you love it. You're just going to have to deal with it. But I just watched the Taking Out the Trash episode. So yeah, there's a bit of that at the moment too. So yes, David and I will be talking about stuff. So if you have a question for us, send a short voice note to thepartyroom@abc.net.au. See you, Mel.
See you, PK.